Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a poetry reading co-sponsored by the University Professors Program and the Humanities Foundation at Boston University. The featured speaker is award-winning Irish poet Greg Delante. We begin with an introduction by Boston University Assistant Professor of Humanities, Meg Tyler.
Today I'm delighted to welcome Greg Delante, who was born in Cork and educated at the National University of Ireland in Cork. He became a U.S. citizen in 1994 and was a Green Party candidate in the Vermont state elections in 2004. His publications include American Wake, The Hell Box, The Blind Stitch, and The Ship of Birth. His collected poems, 1986 to 2006, was published in 2007. His anthology, Jumping Off Shadows, Selected Contemporary Irish Poetry, edited with Nuala Ní Gonail, came out in 1995, and with Robert Welsh, he has edited the selected poems of Patrick Galvin. Among the awards he has received are the Patrick Kavanaugh Award, the Alan Dowling Poetry Fellowship, and the Austin Clark Award. His translations of Aristophanes' The Suits and Euripides' Orestes both appeared in 1999. He is artist in residence at St. Michael's College in Vermont, and please let's welcome Greg Delante.
I love poetry on radio rather than on the video or seeing people. I often think that poetry on the video is diverting because you see the person and you say they're very distracting from the reality of the poem, which is a different thing altogether from one's idea of a person who writes the poem. I've always not allowed a photograph on my books because I've often thought if they saw me, they'd say, how could he write a poem? Or, which I thought was a compliment, I suppose, if you think about it, because it would be even worse if they looked at you and said, oh God, he must be a very good poet. But anyway, as I was trying to fix up my reading before the reading, I looked at my poems, collected poems, 20 years and some others, and it was one of those days where I couldn't find anything that I liked. So, you know, you sing them a bit too much. You know, you go, I've been reading a lot around, and so you get tired of your own poems. So I'll pretend, and maybe I even get to like them as I'm going through them again. Do you know? But the first poem is an epigraph poem from the collected poems. It is actually a poem from my next book, which is the Greek anthology, Book 17. As you know, there is no Book 17, and it's all by made-up characters, and one of them is Gregory of Carcass. News in flight. We fly over the city. The screen flashes current news. Nothing, it seems, but killing and mayhem all round. Daily, we're brought low. How lowly we've fallen. Hardly anyone says a word. Urban lights stretch into the rural night below. Even fewer mention such wonders. The lights are like those of countless fans at a concert, holding up candles to their gods. The group, Homo sapiens, fleeting as any. Yet gods nonetheless, bearing mayhem on the one hand and marvels on the other, as is the way of any regular band of gods. That was by Gregory of Carcass. The second poem I read is a poem to my mother, Eileen. You know, when you're a child, you're given jobs to do in the house. My job, because every one of my jobs, which I didn't get that many jobs now, I must say, was to thread the needle for my mother when she was sewing, because the rest of them didn't have great eyes. Do you understand? So that was one of my jobs. So therefore, the poem came out that it's about a page long. I've become aware, I tell people now how long the poem is so that you know that, you know, it's not going to go on for 4 pages or when is he going to end. And it does make a difference. I mean, I look always at the next page to see when the poem ends. Not so much that I have, short attention span, though I probably do, and I'm getting more short attention span as time goes on. But I remember actually, twas Christopher said it to me, what David did it, and it was a good. I thought it was a good idea. I've even extended it, David, and I put up the book and I show it to the audience so that you are physically aware of this is not an epic. Which I'm really saying is that you all have short attention spans and I don't. Excuse me. To my mother, Eileen, there is a word in this called Omadon, which means fool, dull, dullard. You know, it's from Gaelic. To my mother, Eileen, I'm threading the eye of the needle for you again. That is my specially appointed task, my gift that you gave me. Ma, watch me slip this camel of words through. Yes, rich we are still, even if your needlework has long since gone with the rag and bone man, and Da never came home one day, or Dan. Work, work, work. Lose yourself in work. That's what he'd say. Okay. Okay. Ma, listen. I can hear the sticks of our fire spit like corn turning into popcorn with the brown insides of rotten teeth. We sit in our old Sleevemish house. Norman is just born. He's in the pen. I raise the needle to the light and lick the thread to stiffen the limp words. I peer through the eye, focus, put everything out of my head. I shut my right eye and thread. I'm important now, a likely lad instead of the Omadon at Dread School. I have the eye, haven't I, the knack? I'm Prince Threather. I missed it that try. Concentrate, concentrate. Enough yakety yak. There, there, ma, look. Here's the threaded needle back. That book is from a book called The Blind Stitch, and that's the first poem and the last poem in it. It is a kind of, the book is set as a kind of palindrome, subject matter wise. And the last my feelings about art and life are not unlike W.B. Yeats, the great poet W.B. Yeats. For me, they're a palindrome. One doesn't come before the other, they are each other. And thus, that's part of the idea of the palindrome in the book, the subject palindrome at least. But the last poem is an American sonnet. These have been called American sonnets, which means that they're just 14 lines and nothing else. This is what I assumed. I mean, in the sense that they're 14 lines and they don't rhyme, they're not Shakespearean, they're not Petrarchan, and they're not, you know. And they spread out a bit more. The blind stitch, you know what a blind stitch is, of course. Huh? Do you know what a blind stitch is? I didn't either, but when I heard it, I thought they must get a poem out of it. It's the stitch that you can see in your clothes that, you know, some, there's a certain stitch you can do, and it's the inside of the cloth or the sewing. So there you are. The blind stitch. I can't say why rightly, but suddenly it's clear once more what holds us together as we sit recumbent in the old ease of each other's company, chewing the rag about friends, a poem we loved and such like. Your Portuguese skin, set off by a turquoise dress, doesn't hinder either. But there's something more than tan deep between us. I saw a button to a vest you made me raveled years ago. You hemmed it with the stitch you mend a frock with now. Our hands, without thought for individual movement, saw in and out, entering and leaving at one and the same time. If truth be told, the thread had frayed between us unnoticed, except for the odd rip. But as we saw, love is in the mending. And though nothing said, we feel it in a lightness of mood or ease or blind stitch. It's a poem about marriage. I mean, the students here now, and I'm just thinking, you know, often when you look at your parents, I suppose, you say, God, I hope my marriage doesn't turn out like that, because there doesn't seem to be any affection between that. And yet there is, do you know, but it's just more of a history and other things involved. It's not the heroin shot of being in love, as it were, of the early on thing, do you know? But I thought for a laugh, and I didn't intend to do this, and I see students here. I'm going to say the first poem I ever had published. I've never had it, I never put it in a book. It's about catching a girl or a woman, well, a girl in my case, at about 17. And I hope I can remember it now, but and it's not a very good, it's okay, do you know what I mean? I wouldn't put it in anything, but so what, you know? But it's about catching a girl's eye. I won't go on, there's a story to it. This girl in university that I had a terrible crush on when I went to when I was 17 or 18. So, again, I stand ankle deep in the river and quiver with a placing of bait on the hook of the gut that's cast through the eye in the rod. Through the air, I hear the reel spin and sing, and you hear and turn and stare, and we are caught in space with the weight sending us down and down to a lee's bed and sand and unsettled sand drifts. Do you know? So there you are. I still like that a bit. But I'm going to say another poem by another poet now. Patrick Kavanagh, the great Irish poet, who in many ways brought the rural world that Seamus Heaney and John Montagu, great poets, into a place where it becomes a literary reality to everybody, recognisable, and at this point almost conventional. But they also use it, he was the first poet to use it as in a metaphorical sense. The landscape is metaphor. Seamus is the marvellous North poems, or his father poems, you know, where his father is the follower, and, you know, it could be tradition, you know, where it breaks from the literal into the metaphorical. And, you know, this was the first, I think, Kavanagh had done this, Patrick Kavanagh. It's a simple poem, marvellous poem, called To the Man After the Harrow, where man is just, you know, ploughing the field, but of course it's metaphorical for all of us. To the man after the harrow. Now leave the check reins slack. The seed is flying far today. The seed like summer against the black eternity of April clay. The seed's as potent as the Hebrew book. I have to start it again. You'll have to change that on the radio. Now leave the check rein slack. The seed is flying far today. The seed like summer against the black eternity of April clay. Seed as potent as the seed of knowledge in the Hebrew book. So drive your horses in the creed of God the Father as it stuck. Forget the men on Brady's Hill. Forget what Brady's boy may say. For destiny will not fulfill unless you let the harrow play. Forget the worm's opinion too of hooves and pointed harrow pins, for you are driving your horses through the mist where Genesis begins. The only danger of reading other people's poems, who are fabulous poets, while you're reading your own poems, is that one feels that you're slumping into your own poems the next thing. So, but I'm going to read a metaphorical poem. Again, another American sonnet. This is called Loose Strife. And, you know, I have a lot of poems, what people call political poems or public poems, but for me they're private poems reacting to public things. I mean, I can't see why it's more not more public than love or poems about your parents. Do you understand? Maybe you do. I'm speaking now to some of the younger people. Do you know Loose Strife? Do you know what it is? It's one of those plants that has been brought in and it's destroying all the native vegetation. It's a beautiful plant. And it's growing all over New England and it's, of course, it becomes metaphorical. But anyway, Loose Strife. You have become your name, Loose Strife. Carried on sheep, spurting up out of ballast, a cure brought across the deep to treat wounds, soothe trouble. There have been others like you, the rhododendron, the cattails that you in your turn overrun. Voices praise your magenta spread, your ability to propagate by seed, by stem, by root, and how you adjust to light, to soil, spreading your glory across the earth, even as you kill by boat, by air, by land, all before you, the hardy iris, the rare orchids, the spawning ground of fish. You'll overtake the earth and destroy even yourself. Ah, or Loose Strife, purple plague, beautiful us. On that vein, I was going to read another poem, but I'll read another sonnet, which is, it's a sonnet I like, but I don't think it's one of my better poems. Do you understand? It's a literary poem, I suppose, in many ways. It was a poem I wrote while I was reading W.B. Yeats and Patrick Kavanagh. Yeats's poem, Labis Lazuli, and Kavanagh's poem about the geese. And, you know, Yeats's poem, the poem says it. A lot of my poems, when I write them in sonnets, are to do with complicity about being alive, which is, you know, no, we're all complicit now, whether we like it or not, even if you're living in Ireland or west of Ireland or Europe or, do you understand, in general? We can't buy something without somebody else being affected, often badly. So, you know. But also, this is a reaction to the more grander views of very fine poets, great poets, whatever great means, poets that last, and their body of work lasts. in times of war. So, the monocled poet delights in the two Chinamen seated there on the cracked, lofty, lapis blue slopes under snowdrops of cherry blossom. Their serving man caresses plaintive strings as the wise myops in the cute little halfway house, sipping green tea, stare on all the tragic scene. Their ancient eyes glitter gay. Over them flies the spindly-legged bird, longevity, croaking in the mind, all will be okay, okay. Elsewhere, a bit along the rocky slope, and of a par, another poet eulogizes geese flying in fair formation to Inchicore. How their wings will outwing the war. Oh, my two poets I stare by. I know my station. But what of the mother stooped over her child, the wild pen over the limp signet, the pen defiled? And now to something a little bit lighter. I have come to the States. I came to the States 20 years ago. And, you know, I don't like to talk about Ireland in a way that makes it sound simple, because it's definitely not simple and it's a beautiful place. But I will say that when I left, as you may remember, the restaurants weren't great and we didn't have that many vegetables, and we didn't like eating them even when we did. You know, we had cabbage and we had peas and beans. Do we even consider right? But I was fascinated when I came to the States with all the vegetables you'd see on the street, you know, New York and etc. Particularly fascinated by the gourd, because I couldn't understand how so many of them, how the gourd could look so different, and there are so many and they look so different. And I have just a special fascination for the gourd. You might say I'm a bit of a gourd freak. But so I got this poem out of it. It's a poem that nobody ever talks about in any review, so therefore I stand up for it every time. The Orgod. There's something about the gourd, how each can look so absurd and so different from the other. Compare the egg gourd, say, with the Turk's turban, or swan with the crown of thorns, pear, a caveman's club, dolphin, pumpkin, or the serpent inciting sin and knowledge. How could they be kin? They're as various as their uses. Currencies, condoms, birdhouses, marimbas, you name it. And the name, the concealed god within. Or gourd, whispering, we're all the same beneath the rind. The god we scour the earth for on our knees. Or word, who art on earth, hallowed be thy gourd. All is humour. The next poem, I'm going to read for the type is smaller, so the glasses have to go on. I was in New York and the snow was down, and it was after kind of, it was gone black because of the, what you call it, the soot or the atmosphere. Black snow, short poem. And a reference back to my childhood days, as when they were telling us about when we sinned, all our souls would be specked with little black, the venial sins. And of course, when it was a mortal sin, just all black, you were gone. We believe this. We really believe, I still believe it somewhere in me, even though I don't believe in Do you understand me? But I still, you know. It's impossible to explain this to if you weren't there. Black snow. David points at the two-day snow bunkers along Broadway. Not the natural jaundiced yellow of melting slush, but as if a storm of smog snow had fallen. He remarks, that's what we breathe in every day, reminding me of how the nuns describe the soul as a flake of snow, and every trespass soot darkens that whiteness of whiteness. Ah, the soul of the world is made manifest to us today on Broadway and 82nd. A fuming, black, exhausted snow soul. Woebegone as a bewildered oil-slick bird unable to fly. I laugh, not without cynicism and apathetic stoicism. Qualities necessary these days to survive, or rather, get by. This is a poem, a little short poem, called The Great Ship. Both books. It's a poem I like. I might even like it today. Am I acting well? Do I look, you know? Am I? Again, you'll excuse me, but for younger people, what's the great ship? Can you tell me what the great ship is? The younger people, can you tell me what was the great ship of the last century? You said it, I think. Did you say the Titanic? Yeah. And of course, it's a metaphor for mankind, etc. Do you know? And when the ship was going down, they sang the song, "Nearer, My God, to Thee." And of course, even the atheists sang it, if only because the song was a comfort. The great ship. Later tonight. Is to turn cold. The old, sudden, sharp, iceberg cold of New England. Crickets, cicadas, grasshoppers and frogs play on. What their songs and wing music are saying, I can't say. Except they must know already that the ice has gashed a gaping hole in the hull of Indian summer, and they are the quartet that comes out on deck and plays away as the great ship goes down. We listen quietly from our deck's lifeboat. Play on, brave, noble souls. Play on. Nearer, my God, to thee. Nearer to thee. A poem which I wasn't intending to read now, but I'm switching slightly. There's a word in Irish. It's a poem to the blue people. Black people, I'll ruin it if I say it. One should not tell everything about a poem, maybe. But there's a word in Irish that black people are not called black people. What's the word for black in Irish? Fardov. They wouldn't be called Fardov. Do you understand me? Well, far would be man. They're called something else. There's an intangible lazulite blue, a sheen that glistens off fresh fallen snow. Something akin, but not quite the same as you see shine off the back of a barn swallow, the abdominal of a regular bluebottle fly, the obsidian, clear night sky, the teal of an oil slick, or the halo of a gas stove flame, till, visiting Soweto, I realize it is the hint, glint, light, shimmering of people on white. Finally making sense of why a black man in Irish is called An Fear Gorm, the blue man. I wrote one of the books in the collect. One of the books was a book called The Hell Box. My father was a compositor, and you know, when a compositor used to set the type back to front, they used to set the type. Again, it's a lost world, you know. And part, of course, the Hell Box is full of lingo that's a lost world. The printers would use words. Like the Hell Box itself was where they threw the type to be melted down and recast. The broken type or the worn type. Of course, that's a metaphor for us all. We have to keep remaking ourselves. A metaphor for the melting pot of America as an immigrant. A metaphor for language. You know, it's fabulous metaphor. It took me nearly 40 years to figure out, you know, well, 35, that it was a good metaphor. I mean, it just struck me. Why didn't I get to this a bit earlier? But you know, and I was lucky. But I grew up in the Hell Box. I mean, the Hell Box. Well, yes, I did. I grew up in the Hell Box. The Hell Box was Cork in Ireland, and the particular Hell Box was on Oliver Plunkett Street, the Eagle Printing Company. There's some people from Cork here. And so this is the first poem from it, and there's some jargon. And I use the jargon in a way. I mean, the jargon is gone, but the jargon, because people say, why am I using language? That's gone. It's exactly the reason why I'm using it. Because, first of all, because I like it and I love it and I get a kick out of it, but also because it's about mutability and, you know, we'll all be gone ourselves. And that's all right too. I don't mean to be here sort of as a bell ringer, but also the species will be gone and the planet at some point. I know this is kind of basic, you know this, but, you know. But there's terms also that have come into the language that we don't know has come from printing, like mind your P's and Q's. You know, because the P and the Q in the printing set would be inverted. They were inverted and upside down. They could read upside down and back to front. And those kind of things. You know, things come into the language, and why do they come into the language? And we use them without knowing why. The compositor. Perhaps it's the smell of printing ink sets me off out of memory's jumbled font. Or maybe it's the printer's lingo as he relates how phrases came about. How, for instance, mind your P's and Q's has as much to do with pints and quarts and the printer's renown for drink as it has to do with those descenders. But I don't say anything about how I discovered where widows and orphans and out of sorts came from. The day my father unnoticed and unexpectedly set 30 on the bottom of his compositor's page and left me mystified about the origins of that end, how to measure a line gauge, and how, since he was forced to go, he slowly, and without a word, turned from himself into everyone. As we turn into that last zero before finally passing on to the Stone Man. The next poem is a poem called The Alien. A poem I think if somebody, you know, is one of my, certainly one or two or three of my favourite poems. Not because of the subject matter, because I think it's a good poem for me. Do you understand? But like everything else, like everybody that writes and stuff, you have your favourites in you. But of course, the others start crying out then and you're in trouble. Again, it's about a page long. and it's to a child in the ultrasound, looking at the child in the ultrasound photograph. I'm back again, scrutinizing the Milky Way of your ultrasound, scanning the dark matter, the nothingness, that now the heads say is chock-a-block with quarks and squarks, gravitons and gravitini, photons and photinos. Or sprout, who art there inside the spacecraft of your ma, the time capsule of this printout hurling and whirling towards us. It's all daft on this earth. Or alien, who art in the heavens, or Martian, or little green man. We're anxious to make contact, to ask divers questions about the heavendom you hail from, to discuss the whole shebang of the beginning and end, the pre-Big Bang on time, before you forget the why and lie of thy first place, and, or friend, to say welcome, that we mean no harm, we'd die for you even, that we pray you're not here to subdue us, that we'd put away our ray guns, missiles, attitude, and share our world with you, little big head, if only you stay. Short poem. Little short poem. This morning, a waiter in a dingy cafe was baffled by my attempt at his language. Everyone chimed in to translate. All strangers. The waiter got it, smiled, and everyone smiled. For a moment it was as if a great problem was solved. As if each registered the answer we forgot we knew. The froth of goodwill bubbling up like cappuccino. I should read a cock poem, shouldn't I? I'm going to read a poem called Striped Ink, which is 101, but this is, again, one of the printing poems, Hellbox poems. And it's a poem being sent on a fool's errand. You know what a fool's errand? If you're in... They don't do these kind of things so much anymore, but they used to do them all the time when I was working in places. If you were on a construction site, for instance, they'd send you for a glass hammer. No? Right? But in printing, it was a tin of striped ink. And I was, you know, a little boy, 14, working on the floor with all the compositors. So there. But there's a lot of allusions to Irish mythology. You know, Fionn, when he touches the fish by accident, he knows everything. Fionn is a mythological character in Irish myth. Anyway, you'll get it. Striped ink. I'm smack dab in the old tabula rasa days, bamboozled by the books. Adults bow over, musing if their eyes light upon the white or black spaces. A boyhood later, still rent small, on the top story of the Eagle Printing Company, I see books pour out and believe that if I fish in them, I'll catch the salmon of knowledge, tall tale to us at school, out of the river of words. And, like Fionn, I'll taste my burning hand and, abracadabra, I'll fathom what's below the surface. But if I'm burnt, it's later that day, on my first day as page boy, spaced from fixing leads. The devils, Fred and Dommy, typesetting a new book, dispatch me down to Christy Collin on the box floor for a tin of striped ink. I take the bait and watch floors of labouring women and men flit by, caught in the lift's mesh of X's, drowned out by the machine's hullabaloo. Somehow, between floors, the elevator conks out, and I'm stuck on my message that I still haven't cottoned on to. Seamus Heaney has a poem, The Spirit Level, about it, but he cops them on. This poem was written before that, but that's not, do you understand? It's an interesting twist, that's all. But, so, I'll do one of the poems from the new book, short poem. It's been misprinted in both books, both in the collected and this, something wrong. They should be to my mother in this. It's important, actually, the poem. Normally, dedications aren't that important, though they are important, you know, sometimes who you're dedicating to, because it adds a dimension to the poem. But anyway. Shopping for a compostor. Rooting around what simply looked like refuse bins. I sounded out the petite clerk. Opening an exhibit, she picked up a rotting fruit to expose worms covering the flesh. She talked of them naturally, endearingly even. I'll try to take a leaf from this woman who spoke of the mass of blood-red worms as if it was a rose, and you fresh in the grave, and I unable to help picture you in your coffin dark, covered with such a posy, all the way from your Roman nose to your pedicured toes. And now, I'll read The Ship of Bert itself, the title poem of this. This is a page and a bit. Look out, it's my longest poem tonight. For months, your crib is docked, waiting for you, laden with a shower of gifts, hand-knit boots with suede soles, mounting drifts of rompers, bibs, hats, and a slew of other offerings laid on your ship of birth, with the Ark story embroidered all about. In this birth, the creatures have mostly mirthful faces, the cachinnating chickadees, the stout stoat, the grinning elephant trunk bailing the boat, the trowel owl, the odd rainbow trout, the one-humped camel you might think is pregnant on its back, the polar bear yodeling upon a melting green berg, the avungler ant, not to speak of the circus of unrecorded creatures on your kid attire. Is this saying unbeknownst to us that we gather around the baby, the great circus of the earth, the flying hippopotamus, the fetus-like manatee, the dark stork, the delirious giraffe, not just for a sappy laugh, but to illuminate their dearth and our sapien do-doing as we fish mount sorry, 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 sorry. Our little lambkin, waxwing, luckling, all the cordial choir are Noah calling you now. The lovelice, the leech of paradise, the how now down cow, the forever gone bird, the dolly sheep, the flying kiwi, the crying with laughter jackass, the pronghorn, the bristleless porcupine, the schizophrenic platypus, the licorice black crow, the rhinoceros, that ancestor of the unicorn with an overgrown thorn horn. Listen, the horns are blowing, trumpeting you or their humicorn, beckoning you onto the ark out of your first watery dark. Hurry now, baritones the polar bear, or icebergs are melting out here. Quack, quack, the duck sections quack. Darn, darn, Basso bleats the goat, stomping time with his hoof as the chorus raises the roof. All aboard, our poor wee barn. So one more poem from this, and then I'm going to finish up with a very short poem from the Greek anthology, which are much more interesting for me now. Writers of poems are much more interested in what they write now, even if it's far more inferior to what they've written before. They think it's good now. Do you understand? So I think it's good now. And that's all right for me. And you'll have to put up with it. But I'm going to finish off with the last poem. It's a poem set in Cork. And Aseldama it's a poem about complicity, as it runs through the whole collected, really. It's a quote. Aseldama was the field that they bought from with the 40 pieces of silver, you know, when he threw them on the ground back. But there's a quote, and then I'll and there are songs like Beautiful City that they all sing in Cork, as my mother would. Aseldama, and then the quote is King James Bible from Matthew. And Judas cast down the piece of silver in the temple and departed. And the priests and elders took counsel and brought with the pieces of silver the potter's field to bury strangers in. Wherefore that field has been called the field of blood unto this day, which is Aseldama, which that's what that means. We drove down what seemed the curve of the earth, sandwiched in our Ford Anglia. We were happy as the colours of our beach ball, a careless car full of mirth and sing-along songs. Songs that were mostly as sappy as the soppy tomato sandwiches sprinkled with sand. Which is why they're called sandwiches, our father said. Sandwiched himself now in the ground between his mother and ours. What's the meaning of dead? Which one of us children asked that as we passed the spot with the lit steel cross on Cars Hill? Putting the kibosh on the next song, our mother about to break into Beautiful City. She crossed herself, saying, that's the place they bury those whose lives somehow went wrong. Betrayed in one way or other, without a song to their names or a name, everyone buried together and alone without a headstone. The crepuscular loneliness of the field shrouded or bright time, or world the city below shimmered like the silver pieces scattered on the dark floor of the temple. Then, just to finish up, from the Greek anthology, that great next book written by all those other characters who are not me. This one is by Longleaf. Same Greek and thing, but to finish up new poem. Another time. A man played a squeeze box in a pub that's one of the old types. Lyceum of another time. He braille buttons the melodeon. Squeezes life back into a worn tune with sure, lightning skill. People jaw away around the bar. No one pays heed to this avatar. The air necromanced into music. Not even the player himself knows how good he is. The tragedy is not so much that nobody notices a god, but that the gods don't even know they are gods.
You've been listening to award-winning Irish poet Greg Delanty. Tonight's poetry reading was co-sponsored by the University Professors Program and the Humanities Foundation at Boston University. We began with an introduction by Boston University Assistant Professor of Humanities, Meg Tyler. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's show was produced by Tim Skog and Michael Garth. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.